copyright forum of Christian leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
We're going to reconsider unity. At one level, it seems beyond controversy that some things are beautiful and some things are not. You know, how often have we looked at a beautiful sunset and we just have one thought, beautiful? Mm-hmm. Or we listen to a Bach cantata and we say, beautiful, a beautiful person, a beautiful play. But this notion is not as self-evident as we might think. In the 1960s, both in Europe and in North America, there was a considered critique of the criterion of beauty that was put forth in many sectors, particularly the university. And because since Nietzsche and Heidegger and Foucault and others who believe that knowledge is power, many scholars made the equation between declaring something beautiful and having authority over it, an oppressive authority. There's a position of superiority. I say this is beautiful, that means I have power over it. And so the notion of beauty gradually went into hibernation. There was an incident at Harvard University in a seminar on poetry where some poem was read by the professor, and at the end, a student rather innocently said, beautiful. And the student was laughed at and mocked. We don't say that here. This is stuff of oppression. I know. Okay, sorry. Well, of course, you can't suppress the sense of the beautiful for too long without there being a pendulum swinging in the direction. So in the 90s, people began to resurrect beauty. It came out of hibernation. There was a thaw. And they did it in a number of different directions. Philosophers tried to bring Immanuel Kant back into the discussion. He had talked about the sublime as though it was an objective standard. Elaine Scarry, whose book may be in your bibliography, I can't remember if I put it there or not. Nope. She wrote a book, a fascinating book, based on a seminar that she gave. The Beautiful, On Being Beautiful, and the subtitle of the book was Being Fair and Being Just. And she noted, she argued throughout the book, that in many languages, the word for fairness means loveliness, but it also means justice. And so she argued that a person who was declaring something beautiful was not necessarily declaring their superiority in an unfair way over it. Another criticism of beauty was that it gave you a sense of real superiority over whatever it was that you were looking at. She said, no, a truly beautiful argument makes you humble instead of arrogant. And she noted many examples, Virgil before Beatrice in Dante's trilogy, and so on. So this helped to bring the notion of beauty back into the fore. Christians argued in a slightly different direction. Christians understandably looked at the scripture and translated the many words in Hebrew and in Greek which can be rendered into beautiful, and they saw that there was a simple, almost first level, primary response to something that is beautiful. So, for example, Psalm 27 expresses the desire to dwell in the Lord's house in order to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord. And a number of places recommend worshiping God in the beauty of holiness. 1 Chronicles 16, 2 Chronicles 20, many of the Psalms. Richard Swinburne, a British philosopher, tells us, quote, "Hence, if there is a God, there is more reason to expect a basically beautiful world than a basically ugly one." And some of the most fervent Christian authors and apologists have argued that the best apologetic is aesthetic. In The Idiot, Dostoevsky famously claimed, "Beauty will save the world." However, that first order look at what seems to be the beautiful, and which seems to permit us to apply it across the board to beautiful things, has a number of problems attached to it. Often, Christians unthinkingly adopt the philosophy of Plato into their understanding of the beautiful and see it as being in pretty good harmony with the Bible. Plato taught that beauty was an unearthly harmony, proportion. In this quote here, he who would proceed aright should begin in youth to visit beautiful forms. Out of that, he should create fair thoughts. And soon, he will of himself perceive that the beauty of one form is akin to the beauty of another. And that beauty in every form is one and the same. So for Plato, there were forms which were in the heavenlies, which included the beautiful, whose imprint was to be discovered here on earth. But we've been alienated from it, so we need to remember, memorialize it. You may recall Plato's illustration of the cave, where he sees these people facing the back wall of the cave, and there's a light that emanates from the front of the cave, but all they can see is their shadow. And Plato makes a good deal out of this illustration. He says, most men are looking at shadows, and they can't see the source because they have lost the gift of remembrance. So he suggests that people turn around and move out of the cave to the source. Now, beauty as unearthly harmony, full of forms, then comes into human existence and is remembered. This view influenced Augustine, who found that everything is beautiful insofar as it exists because of God. In the Confessions, he says, worms are beautiful for their purpose. Even evil is beautiful when related to punishment. Everything reflects the beauty of God. Thomas Aquinas declared that beauty derives from the properties of God's Son. Such received beauty includes three conditions, he taught in the Summa. First, perfection. Second, proportion. And third, brightness. And many theologians, after Thomas Aquinas, Protestant and Catholic alike, would have endorsed this idea that earthly beauty, to the extent that it has perfection, proportion, and brightness, is a reflection of the divine beauty. Now, this has interesting repercussions in the history of art. In the first centuries, in this case, in Byzantium, icons were used to signify, yeah, sorry, I'm in the way. I knew this was going to happen.
Change the
yeah, excuse me. I'm blocking you behind that. icons were used to show in an earthly replica the heavenly significance of things. So here is a Madonna with child from the 4th century. What does she look like? Tell me about her face, her posture, what she's wearing. Don't be shy.
Heavens, blue and stars.
Blue and stars, yeah, symbol of the heavenlies and of purity and virginity. Come on.
She looks Samba.
She looks what?
Samba.
Soma?
Soma.
Somber.
Somber.
Oh, somber, sorry, yeah. I thought you were talking about this drug that Huxley liked, Soma. Yeah, she's very somber, isn't she? She's very serious. She's not really a person. She's an icon. She's gazing at you, but almost gazing through you. And of course, it's charged with symbolism. Look at the little baby. Is he such a baby? He's a little grown-up. And he's got his hands in her hands in a very non-childlike position. And he's gazing out perhaps to the future life that he's going to live. This whole painting is charged with pedagogical information. This is Our Lady. This is her child. This is the way the heavenlies are. And therefore, on earth, to replicate this. I don't have slides on all of this, and I apologize, but when you get to the great Gothic architecture of the Middle Ages, you'll find that it was an attempt to have an earthly imitation of heavenly things. So the floors were simple Greek proportions, because of what Thomas said, perfection, proportion, and brightness. In the High Gothic, they began to thin the walls out. That's why you have these flying buttresses to support them, in order that there could be maximum space for the great stained glass windows. And these stained glass windows themselves had pedagogical intent, but they were also to allow in a mystical penetration of light, which bathed the entire cathedral, so that when the worshiper entered, as many did and declared, they were to sense that they were truly in the presence of heaven. One king, when he entered into one of Abbot Suger's structures, declared truly he was in the presence of God, the Virgin Mary, and her child in heaven. So the heavenly reality was Christianized, but still very Platonic. Now, this is very, very simple. If there are any art historians here, I apologize. But as you move through the early centuries in the middle to high Renaissance, you begin to have some humanization. Who is this?
St. Francis.
St. Francis. And he loves nature, not because nature is a pedagogical backdrop to highlight an iconic virgin and child, but because it's a real place that God created. He fed the birds, he loved the birds. Now you know he's a saint because of different signals. He has a halo, and the light is on him, and the center of the painting is his hands. And people would know that, according to tradition, he would receive the stigmata after a prayer of dedication. So here is his hands, not happy yet, but they're ready for it. So there's still symbolism and pedagogical value here, but it's far more human. I don't know if you've ever visited Assisi, but you can see him in St. Catherine in these incredible frescoes by Giotto. And he's beginning to be more of a real person. By the Renaissance, the Madonna and child, it's a real mother and a real baby. Obviously, the model here is a bambino, she's far less austere. She's looking maybe not somber but sad, because she knows what's going to happen to him. But there's also a mother's affection. And the baby is, right now, pretty happy to be in his mom's arms. And so, in the Renaissance, for many reasons, including, I think, strong Christian reasons, artists and poets began to see the human face of reality and not just use it as a kind of platonic way to get a message across about the forms. Now, many centuries later, instead of subjects that are heroes, heroines, mythological figures, iconic teaching moments, painters tried to depict nature. And here, Paul Cézanne, the artist of Aix-en-Provence, who painted the Montagne de Sainte-Victoire some 60 times and did more drawings of it than that, was obsessed with this mountain, is giving one of his many versions of this mysterious mountain that jumps up out of nowhere in the horizon in Aix-en-Provence. It's a granite mountain. And notice that while it is close to nature, there's no mistaking this scene, yet it's not a naturalistic picture about the mountain. Cézanne once said, "Je vous dois la vérité en peinture." I owe you the truth in painting. And he didn't think the truth was by pulling away from nature into pure abstraction. But he also didn't think the truth was in photographing reality. The 19th century was a very interesting time for the movement away from the Renaissance ideal of painting the truly human, towards what would later become quite abstract. And in the battle to either stay faithful to nature or to become abstract, there were a lot of arguments and counter-arguments that defended the propriety of copying nature or not. You know, the Impressionists rendered their sense impressions about nature, not what nature taught. One of the most interesting characters in the middle of the 19th century was Charles Baudelaire, the great poet. Baudelaire wrote The Flowers of Evil, which were forbidden, certain poems of which were forbidden because they were extremely raw. Baudelaire wrote, he was as good a art critic as he was a poet. And Baudelaire wrote reviews of art shows. And one of his most famous reviews is The Salon of 1859, which was in an exhibit hall in Paris. Hundreds and hundreds of paintings that were exhibited. And he basically says most of it's kind of junk. It's sentimental. A few masterpieces are there, and these were the Delacroix and the great masterpieces. And then in the middle of his essay, he launches a fierce attack against photography. Now this was, remember, the beginning of photography, which a lot of it was invented in France. You had Daguerre, who took photography a step forward with interesting techniques. And we have photographs of the American Civil War, thanks to daguerreotypes. Of course, it became much more sophisticated later. But Baudelaire believed that the problem with photography is that it quashed the imagination. It was a pure reproduction, naturalistic, and therefore allowed the artist no place for the exercise of imagination. Many of us who love photography think he got it wrong. Although, when you look at the photographs that he was criticizing, at that time, indeed, many of them were just trying to reproduce some slice of life so you can understand. But he was adamant that artists and poets and painters be free to exercise the imagination. And so, Cézanne was heavily influenced by Baudelaire and believed that even though he had to stay faithful to nature, rendering the truth that he owed was an act of imagination. So he imaginatively gives us these horizontal layers, the branch, the fields, the different blue and white flowers, more fields, leaf fields, and then the strange blue color of the mountains and the slightly different blue color of the sky. This layering was some of the first steps towards abstraction. Now, Cézanne never went abstract, and it's a lively art historical debate as to whether he was indeed the father of Cubism or not. Picasso claimed him. I am not convinced that he rightly claimed him. That's another story. But the point is here that the arts were free from just being iconic and platonic. But in the process, because there was no strong, deep Christian consensus, biblical consensus, the artists were forced to search for the truth outside of revelation. As one of the great scholars of Cézanne, Denis Coutagne, points out, he wanted to find the truth in painting, but you can't find the truth in painting without a background in revelation. And many artists were trying to find the truth in abstraction. It wasn't there. And however much you added imagination and expression, unless you have a reason for unity and diversity, and you have a reason for revelation, you can't have it. So Christians, in the wake of this, I think have felt somewhat lost. Many Christians today that I know and I talk to have a platonic language about beauty. And even though the arts have become less and less platonic, Christians try to defend the propriety of these great ideals. And in the process, unwittingly perhaps, have become very subjective. The saying, beauty is in the eyes of the beholder. No one actually knows where it comes from. It might be a distortion of something Plato said. But it's a very 19th century kind of saying. It's meant to reduce beauty to a matter of personal taste. Almost the same people, those ways some people love carrots, others like broccoli, some people like savory, some people like sweet. And please don't mess with my taste, because my taste is mine. So Christians are caught between some desire of finding absolutes and some sense that there's a subjective right that we have. Now, a closer look at the Bible tells us how different beauty is from either an otherworldly sense of harmony or subjective taste. We should look at a few of the words that are translated as beauty in various English versions, and we'll get a sense of the richness of it. What we'll find is the concept of glory, honor, loveliness. One of the Hebrew words, tif ara, can be translated beauty, but it often refers to glory and honor, not at all to proportion and harmony. Aaron's robe was bedecked in a glory suitable to his rank. The more common term for beauty is yofi, which has a variety of meanings, including the loveliness of a woman, splendor of Zion, and such like. The same goes for hadar, which means splendor. Splendor, majesty, strength, and beauty indeed characterize God's sanctuary. And they do so ultimately because of his presence. But these notions are in contrast to dishonor, lack of dignity, weakness, but not to something we might call ugly. When Isaiah tells us that the suffering servant had no beauty that we should desire, the term there, mar'ed, means something like an attractive face, a favorable countenance. He did not have the kind of attractive face that went with honor. It's not that he was ugly, And surely, prophetically, this refers to his death on the cross, when his countenance, however favorable it might have been, turned to sweat and blood and death. So when the Bible tells us that a certain sight, such as a tree, like the tree in the garden, is pleasant to the sight, it means something like desirable rather than beautiful in the Greek sense. Often the terms for beauty are used about wrong desires. When we're warned against idolatry and seduction, we're told these things are beautiful, don't go after them. So these words matter, but they really don't combine to give us a simple, comprehensive definition of beauty. Splendor and honor and majesty are moral terms that whose opposites are dishonor and moral weakness, not ugliness. So if the Bible isn't of that much help in its words, where do we go? One of our major challenges comes from the confusion people often make between a work of art and the beautiful. A particular painting, a piece of music, a poem, may indeed possess a certain kind of beauty in the sense of honor. Bach chorales, maybe some Beethoven symphonies, would not lead us mistakenly to say how beautiful. The way the voices intertwine, the harmonies follow, the instruments, the chord, and so forth. And yet, many works of art who are equally well-crafted are decidedly not beautiful. This is one of Goya's series on the firing squad in the Spanish Revolution. Nobody would call this beautiful. They're killing these poor victims. Who would attribute beauty to Matthias Grunewald's The Crucifixion? Such works are masterpieces of art, but not because they're beautiful. The Negro spiritual, he never said a mumbling word. It's haunting, profoundly disturbing, but not beautiful in any conventional sense. And of course, some artists and composers have tried to force some sort of beauty into subjects that don't warrant it. We can think of cheap art like kitsch. So if we can't get a lot of help from the biblical word, and if we are challenged by the often mistaken combination of work of art has to equal beautiful before I can accept it, where do we go? Do we have to altogether abandon the concept of beauty, as a few Christian scholars have urged us to do? I don't think we do. A better way, I believe, is to consider the broader notion of aesthetics in the light of biblical revelation. Aesthetics may include beauty, but it's a much more comprehensive term, one that refers to the entire artistic dimension of life. And aesthetics in biblical revelation and in life has three aspects that I want to underscore and which will be the basis for our discussion. The first aspect of aesthetics is to be a presence in the created world. This may be very basic. Certain things enhance our lives. A beautiful table set, lovely earrings, a good background pianist in a bar when you're with friends. All kinds of things highlight the parts of the world which we don't always see as carrying aesthetics, and it helps us to do that. Well, so for example, the presence of urban massive concrete construction to house hundreds of thousands of people, like Corbusier's great apartments in Marseille. This is not an aesthetic presence. This is a almost hellish massification, which doesn't have aesthetic qualities. It doesn't have positive ones anyway. To use the example of the piano in a ballroom, a piano that's intrusive and impedes conversation, a piano that plays music appropriate in some settings but not in others, a person who wears the wrong combination of clothes. So all of these are examples of places where aesthetic presence can go wrong and can be twisted. Now, proper use of aesthetics can include advertising, portraiture, monuments, liturgies, stage settings, or it might be something more profound, more long-lasting, like paintings in a museum. Here, incidentally, we should be encouraged not to think of Christian art as only depicting religious subjects, quote unquote. Rembrandt's, I don't have these on the slides for you, Rembrandt's Side of Beef is a profoundly Christian approach to God's creation. I don't know if you know this painting, this woman creeping in from the side, admiring this great carcass, and it's really a glory to God who makes this and gives us food out of it. It's almost a sacramental aspect to it. On the other hand, Salvador Dali's St. John of the Cross hanging in Glasgow is a profoundly blasphemous painting. It has nothing whatsoever to do with our Savior who bled and died and rose from the dead. It's a well-shaped man hovering over the little village where Salvador Dali comes from in a kind of space that's suspended, and he's not attached to the cross. The cross is a, you have it there? Is that, yeah. Oh, the side of beef on the right, at the door. She's, it's hard to see in a reproduction, but she's gazing in the door.
Yeah.
Well, and of course you know that Chaim Soutine did a side of beef in homage to Rembrandt, but it's a sinewy, fleshly, almost chaotic side of beef, just a cut up piece of meat, as art historians point out, a complete contrast. So my simple point is, you don't need a so-called Christian subject to be Christian. You can paint the crucifixion wrong, and you can paint a simple side of beef right. Maybe some of the greatest examples would be the golden age of Dutch landscape in the 17th century, where these Dutch masters, like Van Ruysdael, painted seascapes and landscapes to the glory of God the Creator, but always there's a fragile threat, dark clouds, threat, a storm coming up. And art historians tell us that he was purposely saying, we live in the beauty of God's world, but it's under serious threat because of the fall. The arts may instruct us, challenge us, help us to see what is less visible, the contours of a mountain, the sadness of a face, or less palpable things, such as love or fear, or indeed the holiness of God. Try to imagine a world without the arts, and you'll immediately see why the aesthetic dimension is such an integral part of creaturely existence. And unlike Plato's ideals, the arts are earthly, parts of the real world we live in. Artists work with stuff, they work with paints, they work with clay, they get their hands dirty. And in the Platonic idea, those are just dim reflections, very inadequate ones, of something much more abstract and much higher, much more universal. I think the biblical notion of the arts is, get in there, get down and dirty with the stuff that God's given you, mold it, and make it into shapes that are aesthetic. The second quality of aesthetics, which probably should go without saying, is that our craft must be good. Throughout Scripture, we're told to be skillful in what we do. This includes wise government, Daniel 1:17, military ability, Jeremiah 15, verse 9, statuary, Isaiah 41:7, fashion, if we can be anachronistic. Exodus 39:24. Of course, music making, playing skillfully, Psalm 33:3, and so forth. To engage in aesthetics with mediocrity or lack of craft is at best a form of laziness, at worst, an insult and an excuse. Now, to be sure, a work of art may be highly skilled and yet blasphemous. As I mentioned, Salvador Dali's Christ of St. John of the Cross, superb painting, absolutely exquisite painting of a Gnostic message. So good, well-crafted aesthetics honors God, the great creator of the universe. Now, we should note here that being well-crafted does not just mean learning the technical skills of rendering your message. C.S. Lewis once said, the Christian writer ought to have blood in his veins, not ink. What I think he meant by that is, if you set about writing with a message, you probably won't be a very good writer. It'll be thin. It'll be propagandistic. If you start off writing because you just love words, you love characters, and you're willing to spend years and years honing your skills at depicting characters, you have a chance at being a Christian artist. Your message will come through. And finally, the third quality I'm suggesting of aesthetics is that there must be profound agreement between what is artistic and what is true. Scriptures tell us we live in a world which was created by God and thus very good. You can think of the artistic dimension of his creation, the glory of it, the playfulness of it. The Hebrew word tov actually means excellent, both in a moral fashion and in a skilled fashion. Into this world, God called mankind to populate the earth, to rule over it. This we sometimes call the cultural mandate, following the Dutch theologian Klaus Dürer. This includes the aesthetic dimension. Genesis 4 explains that in addition to metallurgy, cattle raising, there were musicians who played the flute, and plucked the lyre. Others did poetry. The Hebrews were stronger in literary skills, perhaps, than in the other arts. But they were strong in music, to some extent in architecture. We don't know a lot about their painting skills or pictorial skills. We do know that they could make decorations that were superb. But the aesthetic dimension of life, the world in which we live, is God's world. However, it is profoundly fallen. It's disturbed at its core by sin, misery, and death. In such circumstances, the aesthetic dimension of life has become highly corrupt. Well-crafted statues are now idols, Isaiah 44:13. Music can become so much noise, Amos 5:23. Poetry may be arrogant and vengeful, Genesis 4:23. Here, too, is where the Bible tells us to see the difference between superficial charm or beauty and what is truly praiseworthy. Proverbs tells us the difference in praising the strong woman in the 31st chapter. It doesn't say she's ugly by any means. It just says many women have a kind of charm and beauty, but you have the beauty of character, which is far deeper. And then that wonderful text in Philippians 4, which tells us to meditate and consider on things such as whatever is noble, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, worthy of praise. And so there's a difference in the fallen world between aesthetics used for corrupt purposes and aesthetics used to remind us of the truth. Now that God is redeeming the world, bringing his people to himself through the atonement, the resurrection of Jesus Christ, The arts may bespeak of God's grace. This is why the Lord gave explicit directions for the artwork in the tabernacle, specifically calling gifted craftspeople like Aholiab and Bezalel to work on the symbolism in the tabernacle. To be biblically faithful in aesthetics means to tell the true story: creation, fall, redemption. And in art, this has to be all the more true, as it does in every part of life. This does not limit us to religious art, though there's something perfectly legitimate about that. And this means that artists have many different functions in society. I mentioned their presence in decorative art, but there's the presence in historical art and all kinds of art. One of my favorite artist is Jacob Lawrence, African-American artist of the 20th century, who painted in a semi-abstract manner the stories of African-American people. He spent a whole series on the immigration north. He has a whole wonderful series on Harriet Tubman, who rescued hundreds of slaves through the Underground Railroad. And then with his artistic craft, he takes these figures, such as Harriet, and occasionally will dress her in white, calling her the Moses of her people. And in several scenes, she's acting like a liturgist, bringing sacramental redemption to an oppressed slave. So he, as he declared in many of his writings, wanted to do historical remembering, because it's the tendency of all peoples to forget. To forget not only the hardship of slavery and the emancipation from slavery, but just to forget where we come from, our heroes, our heroines, and to forget that all of this is to the glory of God and can happen again. So there's a difficult balance to maintain between creation, fall, and redemption. Some art celebrates the creation so much that you did not know there was anything wrong in the world. I don't know about over here, but there are late night television shows in the United States which have scenes of beautiful waterfalls and mountains and oceans and little scripture verses on God the Creator. They have a primary sensuous beauty to them, but you see nothing of the intricate skill of God the Creator deeply involved with his creation. And you certainly see nothing of the misery and the rebelliousness of the fall. Or the artist we all love to hate, Thomas Kincaid, with his impossibly saccharine scenes of houses at Christmas where there's harmony and joy and love and things we all know don't have happening. And he, as a confessing Christian, says, "I just want to bring beauty into the world." But it's not beauty, it's a kind of parasitic opposite of ugliness, which is translated into primary colors, bright lights, very, very naturalistic depictions of obvious symbols like the home, or a tree, or a path in the wind. Others so emphasize the fall that you did not know that there was a creator, but that there was redemption. I think of the Francis Bacon's Screaming Pope, or even Munch, The Scream, which just sold for how many millions of dollars. It's a painting of pure despair. I'm not saying that every artist in every painting can load it up with creation, fall, and redemption, but the oeuvre over a lifetime ought to reflect all three of this. It's a place to be seriously dark, as there is in the biblical literature, the book of Ecclesiastes, the book of Job, dark books. But they're not absurdly dark. There was a movement in the 60s called the Theater of the Absurd, which people like Beckett and others depicted absurd human situations, like Waiting for Godot, where Godot, God, never shows up, and they spent 2 hours trying to decide when he would show up, what he would look like, but he doesn't. This is the art of despair. And there are artists who paint only redemption, but a cheap redemption, not a costly redemption. A redemption that hasn't gone through the valley of the shadow of death, and which issues in what I call happiness rather than joyfulness, which to me are two very different values. It's true of music and painting. Happy music is music where, gosh, everything's okay. There's nothing wrong. Joyful music is music that has brought us out of the depths. Out of the depths I cry to you. And then finally into the light where Israel can once again shine before the will of God. So this notion of beauty is rich, contradictory, and challenging. But I would suggest to us that rather than throwing it out because of its platonic temptations, broaden it to the notion of aesthetics, which means everything to do with the arts in their function in the world, in their crafted nature, reflecting the craft of God, and in the three-part message of creation, fall, and redemption. The glory of God and His saving grace, rather than either a platonic or subjective notion of beauty, is what would be central to our aesthetics. So, that's enough from me. Now over to you.